This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by TurbulenceTraining.com. Boost muscle growth and blowtorch body fat at TurbulenceTraining.com. This is the FitCast. Episode number 7 of the FitCast for Saturday, May 27th, 2006. My name's Kevin Larrabee.
And this is John Williams.
And with us this week, we have a special guest. He is known for such books as The Testosterone Advantage Plan, The Book of Muscle, and as of late, The New Rules of Lifting. He has also written for Men's Health magazine. And without further ado, the rock star of fitness himself, Lou Schuler. Welcome, Lou.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Lou. Good to have you on.
Oh, that's horse shit, and you know it, William. It's Friday night. You couldn't get anybody else.
No, it's Friday night, so it's a special edition with you. It makes it all the more special.
Right, yeah.
I'm going to have to put a warning on this week's show.
Oh, come on, man. We're not on the air. The FCC can't get us, right?
No, they cannot.
The only thing that happens is that the iTunes music store puts an explicit sign beside the podcast. But
That's right. This is an exceptionally vulgar discussion of health, fitness, and nutrition this evening.
That's right. It probably attracts more listeners, though.
If a 14 or 15-year-old can get on their computer to get porn, I'm sure they can still get an explicit podcast. It's not going to be that much of a difference.
Oh yeah, yeah. We just ought to sell a warning label on John Williams. Just this guy talks like a sailor.
That's right. That's secretly why I quit teaching at SMU. I got kicked out for my vulgarity in the classroom.
Yeah, but on the bright side, you got recruited at Yale, right?
Yeah, that's right. They love the controversial types at Yale.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, what's new?
Not too much on my end. We do have some news for the FitCast this week. First off, the winner for the FitCast t-shirt contest is Theodore Gardner. So I will be sending you an email, and you'll be getting a free FitCast t-shirt, which actually got mine, and I posted a picture up on the website, and they turned out pretty good.
Nice. Who won it?
Theodore Gardner. Huh. I don't know if he's from the boards or not, so...
Well, that's cool. And an update on the hot chick and the FitCast t-shirt. That's a reality. I wasn't joking last week. My girlfriend has a friend living in Dallas who listens to the podcast, and she's model quality, and she's agreed to model the t-shirt for us. So old guy will be happy. We can put that in the Friday photos, although it won't be, you know, that risky. It's just a t-shirt. You put it on
the website. We're selling visual sex on a podcast.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I'm technologically a little bit behind, but I thought this was an audio format.
It's always the website.
Yeah, it's run through the website.
All right.
And there's a logo, which I doubt we'll change the logo because Kevin did an awesome job. But you could always.
Yeah, I'm too lazy to touch that again. So.
Yeah.
But also in regards to the FitCast, we are number 15. On the iTunes Music Store for health section, which is nice, and I a huge thank you to John Berardi for throwing us in your newsletter and for all you out there who are subscribing to the FitCast. And lastly, we have to talk this week about an idea that just popped into my head, which is a video FitCast. This would be a 5-minute clip every 3 or 4 weeks that would be a video version of the FitCast in a sense, but it would pretty much just be me reporting on a subject in my local area. But in regards to health and fitness, an example of that would be going to McDonald's, getting some food, and showing the new labels that they have for nutritional information. And it's just something that I'm throwing around. Let us know what you think. And it'd just be about a 5-minute video every 3 weeks. It wouldn't replace that week's show at all. So,
what do you shoot the video with?
I have a mini DV camcorder that my family never uses, and it's just sitting around the house, and it's like a $600 camcorder, so I want to make some use of it.
Nice. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
And Two more things I just have to quickly mention. The Bill Hartman interview that was on last week's show is now available on thefitcast.com separately, so if you want to keep that for your records or whatever. And also, I did an interview with Chad Waterbury this week, so that will be coming up on next week's show. And also, thanks to Bill Hartman, Mike Robertson is actually going to be coming on the show as well in the near future, so keep an eye out for that. But other than that, we should probably get to this week's shakes. I'll go first. This week's shake, I did a pretty lazy shake. All I did was a half a cup of blueberries frozen, half a cup of raspberries, 1.5 scoops of Optimum Nutrition vanilla casein protein, and a cup of ice. That's really about it. I was really lazy, and I didn't feel like putting anything really healthy in it. So, tastes good.
What's your rating? It's pretty good with the Optimum?
Well, the Optimum casein, vanilla casein, tastes like crap unless you put stuff in it. Like, by itself, I could never drink it, so I usually just use it for my shakes or smoothies.
You have to mask the flavor.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, I have a confession. I had a hard day at work today. I barely got home just in time to turn on my computer. So my shake today is actually a Breckenridge Brewery oatmeal stout. So I'm drinking a beer tonight and in the tradition of of Dig Nation.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's tall, dark, and dreamy, as it says on the bottle. But it definitely has a kick. It's one of the darkest oatmeals out there. Good stuff if you guys haven't tried Breckenridge Brewery.
How about you, Lou?
I'm still trying to perfect Diet Coke and whey protein. It's not working so far, but someday I'm going to hit it.
I think we talked that on the show that we're going to try that out 1 week. I still haven't gotten to that. But
I think that's a dangerous combo. It's like the what are those candies that used to fizz in your mouth?
Pop Rocks?
Pop Rocks, right. Yeah. Right. There's always the urban myth that the Pop Rocks mixed with the cola makes someone's stomach explode. That's
but
not good.
You know, I guess if there was such a thing as like diet root beer, because I can remember making those root beer floats when I was a kid. So, you know, I mean, the way the ice cream and the root beer used to cause some fizzing reaction.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You guys remember, was that just like totally before your time? If I just like established myself as being 397 years old?
No, I was there with you.
You were there,
and,
all right.
And there's a little shop down the street that sells soda and ice cream mixtures. They have a whole, it's like a, you know, it's modeled after a 1950s shop, and it's got all different flavors of sodas and their own homemade ice cream. It's really good.
Wow. Now, there's a place to go for the cheat meal, right?
That's right.
Well, anyways, let's get to this week's news.
We report. You decide.
Nice.
I never watch Fox News, so I don't know if that's how it sounds.
I've seen it once, maybe, but I think that's how it sounds.
Sounds good.
All right, who's up first?
I am up first this week, and it's actually a pretty interesting story that I found online, actually on dig.com, but then I ended up going to New York Times and also a website called coolhunting.com, and it's about the new integration between an iPod Nano and Nike running shoes, which to start off sounds nothing too spectacular, but what I read into it, it's just that Nike and Apple are actually joining together to create an iPod sports kit, which they're expecting to retail for about $30. And when you use it, the consumers will actually get information on the time, distance, pace, calories burned, all through the earphones of the iPod Nano. And also, because there's a small sensor about the size of a quarter that goes in the bottom of the shoe. And for these shoes, they actually make special shoes that have a spot for that quarter size sensor. And the shoes are going to cost about like $100. And they're going to be available in about 2 months. And after you're done running, you can actually hook up your iPod to your computer, and it will give you readouts with data and charts and pretty much everything you could want. And also, one thing I found that was cool, that you can set the distance on your iPod, and it will tell you when you're done, say, doing 5 miles, and you can set it for like a half marathon or anything like that. And same thing for a length of time.
Nice. Well, Lou's a big fan of running, so what do you think, Lou?
it just sounds incredible to me. I wrote a thing on it was a different type of shoe that was written up in one of the fitness magazines, and I wrote about it on T-Nation a couple of weeks. I was just amazed at the technology they're putting into shoes. I mean, these things are more sophisticated than my car.
What kind of car do you have?
Oh, a 96 Taurus. I mean, that's the beauty of working at home, you know. It's like, who am I going to impress? They sit in the garage all day with the door shut.
Well, I guess better gas mileage than my Honda CR-V. But yeah, so I found it pretty impressive, too. I watched a little commercial on the Nike webpage. I followed the link from the New York Times. And at first, I was kind of skeptical because I was like, well, most of these sort of interfaces between clothing and whatnot typically involve you plugging it into a computer after you get home and seeing your stats. Like I know some guys that have, you know, GPS watches that can record how far they run, but it's not real time. And I was impressed that this Apple Nike combo was in fact real time. It actually tells you how fast you're running through your earbuds and you know how long you've been running and it, you know, it sequences it with your music as well. So it sounded pretty cool to me.
I was also impressed with the fact that they have shirts and other apparel. Granted, it's more stuff. You know, it's more ways for them to get money out of your pocket. But all this, but they've designed actual clothing to hold the equipment and to, you know, and for the cords to go so they're not in your way while you run. Right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm impressed. I'm not going to use it, but I was impressed.
I don't know if they. I have the full size iPod video thing. I don't know if they make the shirts big enough for those. I'm sure they do.
Yeah, well, said the sensors would only work for the iPod Nano, which really sucks because, like you, John, I only have the full-size version.
Ah.
So I guess they're trying to get you to spend another $150 or $200 for another iPod just for something like this. But, I mean, the price by itself, $100 for a pair of shoes, I know some people that spend more than that on just a simple pair of running shoes, and $30 for the kit, and you really don't even need the shoes. You can just put it someplace in your shoe, and for $30, right, you can have a pretty nice device where you can get some nice stats, and it can track how far you've gone and give you information through your music, which is really nice.
And it does have the software where you can plug in your iPod, your computer after your run, and show your progress over the week. They need to make those for weightlifters, you know, like your own little partner. It encourages you to lift heavier on your deadlift, tells you how much you're lifting, shows your progress.
Yeah, but how would you work it? You know, I remember, I know you're joking, but I was literally, there was a company, I think it was called FitLinks, and this is going back maybe 7 or 8 years, where they actually had equipment that, you know, had video sensors, and they would try to monitor you, and they would try to monitor the speed of your lifts, and you know, so that these things would all get plugged into a computer program, the weight you lifted and the speed you lifted and the number of reps you did. And basically there was no way to do it because, you know, you ended up with a bunch of clunky equipment. If you lifted the weights a little bit too fast, it would, you know, it would try to slow you down or would, you know, would throw everything off. I don't remember exactly what the flaws were, but I just remember there were a lot of them, and you could only do it with equipment that was set up with these special things, so you couldn't even use free weights.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with weightlifting, you come up with I would be stunned if in my lifetime anybody finds a way to improve on a clipboard with, you know, with a piece of paper and a pencil, unless there's like a notebook type of thing where you can, you know, where you can handwrite on like a, you know, on spreadsheet on a computer screen. And of course, my problem is if I'm working hard enough, my hands are shaking. I can't even read my own notes afterwards, you know, that I wrote in pencil on paper. So I can't imagine what it would look like on a tablet PC.
Yeah. I've seen some guys try to use a Palm Pilot in the gym. It just doesn't work. First of all, you got, you know, your dumbbells banging around. It's more likely to get broken, and you're sweaty, and it just doesn't work. Yeah, it would be neat if we could invent something that could record your weights and your progress, but I agree, Lou. I don't think it's going to happen. Not in our lifetime, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I keep this thing that I do, writing books, is so inefficient. It takes so much money. It takes so much time to put all this stuff on paper, to print this paper, You've got to alter the format of what you're doing to fit on the pages of the paper. Granted, in a book, you don't have to do it as much as you do in a magazine. But at some point, you've got to change something to make it fit on these pieces of paper. And I had always thought that there must be something we can do that would give you the depth that you get from a book, but without that sort of clunkiness and inefficiency and expense, that there should be a way to just to do this, to design it in some way, put it on a computer screen and be able to take that computer screen into the gym. So you've got your instructions right there, you've got your worksheet that you can write right into some kind of software program on this thing in the gym, and something that's no more clunky than that, than that clipboard and the paper that we carry around, mm-hmm. at least I do. But it's not there yet.
Right.
And like you said, John, it may be that, it's never there because of what we do. It's, basically we're just cavemen. We're just sweating and grunting and throwing heavy stuff around. And, so maybe there'll be never be a technological way to improve on that.
Plus, I bet there's not a very big market for it, because if you look at the typical gym, there's not even people that bother to carry around a notebook anymore, or ever, probably.
In your typical gym, find a guy who's been working out 5 years, and I'll show you a guy who's still doing the first program he learned 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. They've got it memorized. They don't care about progression. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's learned to do some new bicep curls for muscle and fitness, but, that's probably the only adjustment he's made.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not something that Apple would be too into. Well, Lou, you've got an article that blew our socks off when we were reading. So why don't you give us some information about that?
Yeah, that was I spent much of the fall of 2005 once I'd finished New Rules of Lifting, which is the book that Alan Cosgrove and I wrote. Once I'd finished that, I spent. I can't tell you how many weeks doing almost nothing but researching some issues in fitness that I'd always been curious about. I'd written an article a couple years ago for Men's Health called Death by Exercise, where I asked this question: if aerobic exercise, the way we understand it, which is running or cycling or swimming a very long distance at a steady pace, if this is the healthiest form of exercise we have, why do people die doing it? To me, that was such a disconnect. I never could figure that out. They tell, for example, with strength training, you would think that because people fall over dead doing things like shoveling their driveways and working out in their yard or having sex with a mistress, you would think that people would be dropping over dead all the time strength training in a gym, because it's that exact same kind of stimulus where all of a sudden your heart rate's way up. You stop cold, you don't cool down, you just stop when you get to the end of your set, and then your heart rate goes dropping way back down again. But mm-hmm. nobody ever drops dead in a weight room. It's so rare that it's virtually random. It's no different from, the number of people who drop dead, waiting in line for one of those, ice cream cones at your neighborhood store. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen. But why do people, but every year, a few people, and sometimes often famous or prominent people, drop dead running or riding their bikes? So I said, why does this happen? I'd written this article for Men's Health a couple of years ago called Death by Exercise. Well, basically, all I did was I asked that question, why does this happen? And it turned out there was no answer, that I talked to people who had some theories about why it happened, but I couldn't find anything credible that was worth putting into a magazine. So I revisited that issue, and I began to look at studies that were looking at different aspects of cardiovascular fitness. And some of this stuff I realized nobody ever talks about, and I'm not quite sure why we don't. But one thing I found, which really surprised me, we're constantly told that if you do aerobic exercise the way that people tell you to do it, which is long distances, steady paces, the goal is to build up endurance, that you're going to create these favorable cardiovascular adaptations. That is, your resting heart rate is going to slow down, which is a good thing, that you are going to have in theory, all the blood vessels are going to be more pliable, that there's going to be less plaque built up. In theory, you then create this high-performance engine within your chest, and there shouldn't be anything that ever goes wrong with it. But when researchers, and primarily, interestingly, most of this research is going on in Europe, they looked at one aspect of cardiovascular fitness called heart rate variability. And this is fascinating to me because it measures the beat-by-beat variations of your heart. Every heartbeat is supposed to be just a little bit different. Now, if you have a slower resting heart rate, you should have much more room for variation from heartbeat to heartbeat because they're coming slower. So the electrical signals, there's much more room in between heartbeats for those electrical signals to be just a little bit different. Now, here's something very interesting they found, that when people do a lot of exercise, I mean serious aerobic athletes, their heart rate slows down, their resting heart rate slows down, but their heart rate variability flattens out so that they have less variability from heartbeat to heartbeat than people who are only moderately fit and who do only moderate amounts of exercise, which probably applies to all of us, you know, three or four times a week, strength training, you know, in my case, some yard work, you know, maybe a couple games of basketball, moderate stuff, moderate doable stuff. We're not out there training to be super, you know, endurance athletes. People like us have greater heart rate variability because of the exercise we do. But people who do a tremendous amount of endurance exercise have less heart rate variability than the people like us who do moderate exercise. And in fact, they have as little heart rate variability as completely sedentary people. So why...
This heart rate variability, is this something that you can sort of measure yourself, or is it something you have to be tested for?
It's something you can't be tested for, but it's correlated with longevity, and it's correlated with a very low rate of heart attacks and heart disease. So the more heart rate variability you have, in theory, the less heart disease you have. And in fact, this goes all the way back to the Framingham study. Certainly by the 1990s, I think the ongoing Framingham heart disease study in Massachusetts, I think, is they had been looking at heart rate variability, and they had been finding that the people who have the most heart rate variability have the lowest incidence of heart disease and you know, the lower risk of all-cause mortality. In other words, they don't die as often as the people who have less heart rate variability. So what is it about serious endurance exercise that does all these things that are supposed to happen, like, you know, lowering your resting heart rate, but it reduces your heart rate variability to that of a sedentary person? Now, I can't tell you, I'm not sure, and I don't think anybody knows at this point, if that has anything to do with why some serious endurance exercisers will drop dead, you know, from what they do or you know, shortly afterwards. But to me, it was this really tantalizing hint that we may be looking at this exercise thing the wrong way. And I mean, we may be looking at the whole exercise thing the wrong way. Because no matter who you talk to, there's still the idea that endurance exercise is for health. That's for health and longevity. Strength training, well, there's a lot of, you know, people don't badmouth it the way they did 20, 30 years ago, but they're still not coming out and saying that this does anything other than improve your muscular fitness, which can be correlated to longevity. If, you know, if you have stronger muscles and bones, you may be more likely to have a fall that would be debilitating and obviously shorten your life. But nobody will look at this and say, you know, they look at what strength training, just to pick one example of an activity, they look at that and they say it doesn't change any of these cardiovascular factors. It doesn't lower blood pressure unless you're an absolute beginner or in some other kind of special circumstance. It doesn't lower blood pressure. It doesn't lower resting heart rate. It doesn't do the things. It doesn't change your blood lipids, your cholesterol levels, that sort of thing. Not dramatically, I mean. So they say, so it must not do anything for your cardiovascular fitness, except that it might be training your body to withstand these high stresses. And training for serious endurance exercise may do the opposite. It may make your body more susceptible to these stresses. How it would work, I don't know. I mean, you know, it kind of sucks to be a journalist and, you know, not have gone to medical school so that this stuff would make a little bit more sense. But when I'm looking at these studies, I'm amazed at how uniform they are. That if you look at if the one variable that seems to be across the board beneficial for everything, that seems to reduce all-cause mortality, it seems to be correlated with low rates of heart disease, is intense exercise. A little bit of intense exercise, a lot of intense exercise, something in between, that seems to work, that seems to be cardioprotective, that seems to help people live longer. But the things that we talk about, the type of strength training we do, where you're getting your heart rate up pretty high, you know, doing a set of maximum effort squats, say, is certainly going to do that to your heart rate. We talk about doing interval training for body composition, for reducing body fat without risking a lot of muscle loss. We talk about, you know, how great it is just to get out and play sports, you know, to get out there and do some heavy work in your yard. All these things are great, but these are all intermittent activities. They're not steady-state endurance activities. They all qualify as high intensity because they get your heart rate up there, you know, because at a certain point you're working almost all out in these things. And yet, this is not serious exercise yet in my field, in the prescriptive class, you know, mm-hmm. where we're telling people what they're supposed to do to, you know, have a better life, to live longer, to be healthier. The stuff that works, the stuff that clearly works across the board unequivocally, it's still the stuff we're not talking about. And the stuff we are talking about, it seems to me almost we may be on the wrong track. We may simply be looking at the wrong variables.
Why do you think people have such a visceral reaction to strength training having actually healthy effects for people? People's knee-jerk reaction is typically no. You know, you have to go run for an hour before you can be physically fit. Strength training is just, you know, getting buff and, you know, it's all aesthetic. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think because people who strength train look funny, make weird noises, don't fit very well in the lab coats, you know.
I think the professional.
I don't know. I mean, you know, walk into a Gold's Gym, you know, and you you know, you kind of see, well, this is why people don't like us.
That's a good point. It's probably the Speedos and the clown pants, I think, is what did us in.
Well, I don't know. I mean, all you know, joking aside, there was a from the, you know, there was a study that came out from Harvard. Probably going back 7-8 years, I think, where they actually looked at men who strength trained, and it was a very low amount. It was like at least 20 minutes one time a week, and they found that they had, I think the number was like 23% fewer heart attacks than a control group, men who don't strength train, which I thought was really interesting. Now, the people who did endurance type exercise had a much lower risk of heart disease, which is another one of these paradoxes, which is that endurance exercise clearly does that thing. I mean, it's because in my personal theory, my like grand unified theory of exercise, is that any type of exercise gets you to a certain point where you're better off than you were if you weren't doing exercise. If you're mixing in some intense exercise. And running, let's face it, you know, if you're actually out there running, that qualifies as intense exercise. So clearly you're going to improve your health. You're going to reduce your risk of dying of heart disease or of any other cause. But it's that stuff that they're telling people to do, you know, well, just go out and walk. Go out and, you know, work in your garden. You know, go to the gym and, oh, no, don't get your heart rate up. No, just do a circuit of the machines, 15 reps, don't push yourself. That sort of advice, other than just getting people off the couch and getting them moving, I don't think is really doing people much good. And I know that you can't tell somebody who's totally sedentary, well, you go out and do intense exercise, because that's a pretty good way to kill some people. But if you make it clear to people that the goal eventually is to do something pretty hard, it might be easier for them to accept that they have to sort of get outside their comfort zone if they want the benefits of this thing that they're making the effort to do. And right. if they'd rather, you know, stay within their comfort zone, that's fine. They're still better off doing something than nothing. But I just think that, you know, I sort of have this, and maybe it's even too esoteric a point, but I still have this gut feeling that we're not telling people the real information, either for fear of scaring them off or because we don't want to admit that the real information is, well, you don't need to do a lot of exercise as long as what you do is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I think to most people would say, well, that's a wrong message, whether it's true or not.
That's just not as appealing as getting on a treadmill and, you know, running for 30 minutes at a light pace.
Right.
It's harder to do intervals. It sucks. You're about to die, you feel like, you know, but it's certainly helpful. And just, I don't think a lot of people are willing to go through that.
Yeah. And, you know, and I respect that. I mean, I'm not willing to do a lot of things, I guess, that people think I should do. You know, but, you know, everybody, you sort of have your limits, you know. It's like, mm-hmm. I won't miss a workout, but, you know, I won't clean my garage as often as I should or you know, do my filing or something. I mean, everybody sort of got their limit where it's like, okay, I got my, I've got my must-do list, and I'm sorry, this isn't on it. And for the majority of Americans, heavy exercise is not on the must-do list, and that's fine. It's just that when the conversation is about exercise and you're talking to people who want to do it, I just wonder if we're talking about it in the right way. And I honestly don't have an answer now. It's just I think we should be asking the question a little bit with a little bit more force than we've been asking it.
Excellent point. I mean, I thought something else you brought up in your article was really neat. Just a little fact about fish oil. You said 2 grams of fish oil a day improves the heart rate variability.
I haven't seen
that study yet. Yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah, I really, seeing that, once again, now we're getting into a question that nobody asked until I think fairly recently, which is we sort of came up with this idea that saturated fat bad. We sort of came around to the idea, well, all right, polyunsaturated fat, okay, that's good, or it's neutral. Monounsaturated fat, yeah, that seems to be okay. But we didn't distinguish between these polyunsaturated fats. And now that we're looking at a little bit more closely at the difference between these two types of fat, we're seeing that these omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids, the ones that you find in soybean oil, which is the main ingredient of mayonnaise, corn oil, that sort of thing, the things that we thought were healthier than the saturated fats, it turns out, really aren't, that they create internal inflammation. There are some links to different, you know, different diseases. And we're finding that these omega-3 fatty acids, like the ones that we find in fish oil, have the exact opposite effects, that they've got an anti-inflammatory effect, that they boost cardiovascular health, that they seem to improve your metabolism, to help you reduce body fat. I mean, all these strange benefits to this one type of fat that a few years ago nobody even talked about distinguishing from the other types of polyunsaturated fats. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that's really kind of changed, certainly in the time that I've been writing about these subjects. And it's interesting now, this idea that we really have to keep these two types of polyunsaturated fats, the omega-6, the omega-3s, in some kind of balance so that the omega-3s can cancel out the omega-6s.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
again,
something that I've been interested in.
Right.
As an archaeologist, you know, just because we've done several studies showing that it would be impossible to get the same ratios of omega-6s to omega-3s 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 years ago, just because most of our processed food comes from grains and grasses, like tropical grasses like corn, and people in the past just didn't have that kind of access to corn. You know, a tablespoon of corn oil, you wouldn't be able to eat in the wild in a month, you know. So
sure.
It's over the top right now, that these ratios that we have. So I think it's kind of neat tying it into the past as well.
Yeah, you know, and you think about this, the grazing animals back then would have eaten these wild grasses, which were very high in omega-3 fats, mm-hmm. Which means that their meat would have been high in omega-3 fats. So the early humans who hunted these animals ate the meat, mm-hmm. were getting these beneficial fats just simply from hunting and eating the animals that they killed.
Right.
That they were getting these things that now we have to go to the drugstore and buy in fish oil capsules. They were getting just from, you know, hunting down mastodon.
Yeah, eating animal fat. It was healthy then.
Yeah. Oh, Chris, I got to say, it's kind of cool not to have to kill a mastodon.
Yeah. Well, I know that you've got some, you're talking my language now, Lou, but I know you have some Neolithic Revolution ideas that I definitely want to get into later. So let's put this off for a little later and go ahead and get into the next news article so that we do have time, because I really want to pick your brain on that. You've got some great ideas there. The next article is going to be by me, but it was just a sort of a simple joke article, and I think I'll just pass it up and so we can get to this roundtable and pick Lou's brain. And I know, Kevin, you wanted to talk about an update on T Nation, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to give everyone a quick update, like I promised, on the Bigger Arms in 2 Weeks project. Looks like for many it didn't do too much for them. The goal was 3/8 of an inch for each bicep in 2 weeks, 4 workouts covering those 2 weeks. And a lot of people didn't get the results that they wanted. Some stayed the same, some got very minimal results. One thing that was proven, though, if you look at the pictures on T Nation, is many of the T Nation readers and posters have very hairy armpits. That was mentioned a lot. And it's some scary, scary crap if you look at some of those pictures. I'm not saying don't check out the article, because in the article they do a great job going over the process. But watch out for the pictures that are posted.
I can actually contribute something here. I've worked with a lot of models. I've been in rooms with sweaty guys exercising for more hours of my life than I care to remember. And let me tell you, the models that you see in these magazines, they trim their armpit hair. So here's today's grooming tip. If you're going to take a picture of yourself flexing your biceps, it's okay to trim your armpit hair.
That's right.
Not, as long as you're not shaving, you're still a real guy.
There was some forests in those armpits. They just look odd.
Because after all, you are doing a program to increase the size of your biceps 3/8 of an inch. Is that what the goal was?
Yep.
I mean that's concerned about your image, so you shouldn't be ashamed to shave your underarm hair.
Trim.
Okay, trim.
Don't shave.
The number 4 setting on the trimmers.
Speaking of somebody who cuts my own hair, I know exactly what he means.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, those are the days when I used to shave my head. It was so much
cheaper.
Save
you hundreds of dollars. I haven't paid for a haircut in almost 3 years, and just shave it. I just do it one length over the whole head. I don't care. Gets the job done.
Oh, you know, the reason I started cutting my own hair, you know, I started going bald, noticeably bald, when I was 20, and you know, I was still paying for haircuts. And one time when I was at Men's Fitness, I was on this photo shoot with this model, and this guy had been in a lot of national print campaigns, and he said that he was, you know, his modeling career was going nowhere until he started cutting his own hair with an electric trimmer. And of course, this guy's hair was so thick, it was like, you know, it was like a pelt. You know, I mean, it was almost inhuman. It was so thick. But he had started cutting it himself, and as soon as he did this, started cutting it down to I think he used a number 2 or number 3, so it was like a half inch, you know, half inch at most. And all of a sudden, he started getting all this work because he had this really cool, different look. And I said, this guy, his entire living depends on what he looks like. He cuts his own hair, and I'm still paying for haircuts. And I have maybe 1/8 the follicles this guy has, so I'll tell you what, over a lifetime, save enough for a down payment on a house.
Indeed. Maybe I'll start trimming my hair again with the clippers, although my girlfriend won't like that.
No, John, if you've actually got hair, don't.
Well, it's thinning, so soon enough I'll be in the same boat.
I'm right behind you.
A few more years, it'll happen to you too, Kevin.
Yep. Hopefully by then they'll have the technology to
Well, it's a sign of high testosterone, but it's a sign of high testosterone in your scalp, which doesn't really do you any good. But
I get a ripped scalp. Well, let's move on to the roundtable. I want to hear about your future projects and listener questions and talk more about you, Lou.
Well, how much time do we have?
Forever.
Forever. All right. Forever. Good. All right. So you want to hear about future projects?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I wish I had some. I've actually, for most of this year, since my own book came out in at the end of December, I've been working on two things. I've been working on a book with Chad Waterbury. He's writing, I'm editing. That's a very exciting book. If you like what Chad does on T-Nation, those workouts, he includes those workouts. He explains in greater depth all of his, you know, all of the science and methodology that goes into those workouts, which is fascinating. And then he also has a new workout, which I have tried, and a few select readers have tried, but the rest of the world hasn't seen yet. And I believe it's Chad's best workout ever. I mean, it's just an awesome strength and hypertrophy program. So that book, I have no idea when it'll come out. Have no idea when we'll finish it, but it's really cool. I also wrote a proposal for a book with Alan Cosgrove and a new co-author, Cassandra Forsythe. This is a strength training book for women, which I'm such a doofus. I don't know why I didn't think of doing this a long time ago. Way back when the Testosterone Advantage Plan first came out, I started getting all these questions from women saying, well, you know, can we do these workouts? Can we do this diet? And I said, yeah, of course. You know, I mean, men and women, there's slight differences in physiology, but we're the same species. So, you know, strength coaches I know, especially guys like Alan Cosgrove, you know, they'll tell you they train women just about exactly the same way they train men. They may make, you know, for individual clients, they'll make some changes to reflect, you know, their injury history or their personal goals or maybe some biomechanical problems they have. But essentially, the methodology that goes into the workouts of men and women is identical. But show me a woman who believes that she should be doing the same workout as a man. And it's really fascinating because what you almost never see in a commercial gym is a woman who's working as hard as some of the guys are working. You almost always see a couple guys who are working hard. You'll see a lot of guys who are goofing around or, you know, these guys who've got all day, so they'll do like one set of curls, they'll talk to their buddies for 5 minutes, go over and do another set of curls, you know. And you always wonder, you know, I look back and I say, wow, how does anybody work out for 10 hours a week? Well, that's how you do it. One set every 5 minutes, and, you know, especially if you're doing, you know, stupid crap like curls, you know.
you can stretch out in
the squat rack, right.
Yep, yep.
You can stretch that out all week. But women will work extraordinarily hard in spinning classes. They'll brutalize themselves. They'll work very hard in yoga and Pilates classes. We sort of make fun of those things, but the women who do them, you actually watch them in the studio, and they're working hard. They're sweating. It's tough what they're pushing their body to do. You will not see that effort in the weight room, and whether it's a cultural thing or whether it is you know, just the idea that they're not going to sweat in a room full of guys, or if it's simply a matter of misinformation, if they're doing the wrong stuff because they think that they're not supposed to do the same things the guys are doing. So the title of this book is Lift Like a Man, which is a book for women explaining why they should work out like men, what they can learn from men, getting into a lot of the diet questions. One thing I discovered or my co-author Cassandra Forsythe clued me in on, is you look at the number of calories a woman needs to maintain just her basic hormonal function, just to keep the estrogen flowing, just to keep the thyroid hormones working, the leptin, which helps control appetite, keeping cortisol down, which is a stress hormone that, you know, can really wreck a physique by signaling your body to store fat. You look at the minimal levels of food required to keep these bad things from happening and to make sure the good things keep happening, and then you compare that to a typical book for women and the number of calories they tell them to eat. And the typical book for women will be telling women to eat, say, 1,000 to 1,200 calories a day on these diets. But if you look at what the woman needs, just her basic needs to maintain her hormonal levels, her period cycle, all these things, it's usually several hundred calories higher. The average woman out there who is taking information from books for women, mostly written by women, is starving herself. She is following a diet that is patently, provably unhealthy. And these diets can't possibly work.
Right.
Because right. Because when you're in this high stress, high cortisol, low thyroid hormone, starvation mode, eventually you're going to snap out of that. You're going to snap out of it in a big way. And the problem is that when you're on this diet, you're going to reduce your metabolic rate as your body tries to maintain, you know, its as it tries to hold on to its fat stores. And as soon as you whipsaw off this diet and start eating again, most of the new weight you put on is going to come in the form of fat because you've got this slower metabolism now. Mm-hmm. And granted, eating more calories is going to speed up the metabolism just by itself. But the problem is this damage you're doing to yourself. You know, you talk, you know, you meet all these people and you read about these people who do these yo-yo diets, and you go, wow, how could you do something that stupid? How could you starve yourself and then go off and eat 4,000 calories a day and, you know, and blow up 50 pounds and then go on another starvation diet? When do you ever learn? Well, there is no book out there that tells women not to starve themselves. Just as there's no book out there that tells them the truth about their own bodies when it comes to strength training, which is that their muscles work the same way as men's muscles and will react the same way to the same programs.
Right.
You know, I probably, I don't know if I'm sort of blowing everyone away with the intensity of this, but I was stunned to learn that there is virtually nothing out there that tells women the truth about workouts and nutrition. Nothing.
This is going to be a fascinating book, and I'm glad to see Cassandra is going to be co-authoring it with you.
You know Cassandra?
Yeah, well, I've read her stuff and know of her, and you know she definitely walks the walk too. She's very fit, and you know following her dietary advice, like you said, it looks like a lot of calories compared to what most women eat, and
right.
It's very similar to the advice that John Berardi gives too. And I've been
I'm sorry, John, I forgot. Yeah, Cassandra and John Berardi are friends. John actually introduced me to Cassandra. Right.
Right.
So I'm sorry, I didn't realize that you. I forgot. So we could play 7 degrees of John Berardi here and figure out that John Berardi actually knows everybody on Earth.
Well, it was funny, you know, because when John and I both lived in Texas, he would come up and visit him and vice versa. And some of my friends around the university, they were fairly fit women, and they would go on, you know, 5-mile runs 3 times a week but they were starving themselves, and they were a little unhappy with their body composition. They'd like to be a little leaner, you know, maybe a little more cut. And he was telling them all these case studies and how to get a better body composition. And, you know, his primary advice was, besides manipulating the ratios of protein, fat, and carbohydrates, you need to eat a lot more calories. And they were just like, nope. You're full of shit. Sorry. You know, I know my body. I can't eat more than 1,200 calories even if I run 5-6 miles a day. And he's like, no, seriously. And he has you know, case studies where he doubled these athletes' caloric intakes, and their weight stayed the same, but they gained muscle and lost, you know, like 5 percentage points of body fat. It was just amazing.
Yeah, Cassandra showed me this one study where young female athletes over the course of a competitive season, the ones who were eating the least amount of food had the least improvement in all their performance parameters, and the women who were eating more improved over the course of the season. Mm-hmm. And you look at that and you say, well, all right, what does that prove? Well, actually, it proves something that is absolutely, it's both logical and it's stunning because nobody talks about it, which is that the women who were essentially dieting throughout their competitive season were not getting the benefits of the exercise they were doing. And really, here's something that Chad Waterbury talks a lot about, you know, Alan Cosgrove, going back to Ian King. I've heard this from the smartest people I've met in the fitness business. They all have different ways of saying it, but they say pretty much the same thing, which is that exercise is a form of training. Training means you're teaching your body to do something it doesn't already know how to do. You're trying to make your body stronger. You're trying to make your body faster. You're trying to create more endurance. You're trying to train some variable. You're trying to train your body to do something it doesn't do. And the way your body looks will follow your training. If you're training yourself to be stronger, your body will look stronger. If you're training yourself to have more endurance, your body will eventually look as if it has more endurance. You know, I'm oversimplifying it because we know how important nutrition is, that it's not all on the training side. But here now we have evidence from this study of women that if you're training yourself to reach a goal, but you're not eating enough calories, you will not reach that goal. And I think that you will be able to find that includes not just sports performance, but muscularity, body composition, which are a different type of performance, but it's still performance. You're still trying to teach your body to do something it doesn't yet know how to do. If your body's 12% body fat and you want to get down to 8%, or if it's 30% and you want to get down to 15%, you've got to teach your body to do something it doesn't know how to do, which is to process these calories differently and produce more muscle and less fat. You've got to find some way to do this in conjunction with your diet so that it works, but it's still training. And without the calories, training is meaningless. You cannot train your body to do something if you're not giving it enough calories to reach that goal. And I think that that's something that, for example, I think I hate to say anything good about bodybuilders, but I think they intuitively understand that you can't starve yourself and grow muscle. But with women, they want to starve themselves and still see these benefits that they can't possibly see without higher calorie levels.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. You said this is a proposal so far. Has it been accepted?
Yeah. Right. I've sent the second draft of it to my agent, and he may still send it back and say work on it some more. But this guy is actually the best agent in the business. He's the guy who sold Body for Life. Core Performance. He also represents people who, make like more money in a week than I make in 5 years. So when he says, no, this doesn't work, that means it doesn't work. Fortunately, he likes this idea. So, so I hope that it'll be in the hands of some publishers and I hope within a couple of years we have a book out there for women.
Sounds great. Can't wait for that. And speaking of bodybuilders, you had this great idea that I wanted to pick your brain about. We were exchanging emails before, and Kevin was throwing some ideas around for topics, and you replied with something about the Neolithic Revolution and sort of how this irony of the current bodybuilder who trains to look like he has functional strength but actually doesn't compared to what we did in the past.
Yeah, you and I have talked about this, and we wrote an article for Men's Fitness, and then you and John Berardi wrote an article for T-Nation that used all the information that, I wanted to use in Men's Fitness. but we ended up, we've been talking about this for a long time, and I find it utterly fascinating because there seems to be a point in human history. Well, first, John, you tell me, Homo sapiens, modern humans, how long have we been on this planet?
Well, we evolved about 200,000 years ago. That's the earliest anatomically modern remains in Africa.
And
but we weren't behaving like we are today, so there's a big difference.
Oh, no, we didn't have pornography. But I'm sorry, does that get us a bad rating, Kevin? Are we going to now, 14-year-olds not going to be able to download this?
No, we already dropped a couple bombs, so we'll just let it go. Keep going.
It's got 4 syllables. I mean, right, yeah. That makes it intellectual. All right, so at what point between, so we got this guy 200,000 years ago and we've got this distinctly modern human. At what point did that guy figure out how to make tools?
Oh, they were making tools. Just the sophistication of those tools increased gradually through time until about 40,000 years ago, and you start to see a lot of stuff going on with technology. So we've been tool makers since 2.5 million years ago, probably pushing that back to even 3 million years ago.
All right, so 3 million years we're making tools, and about 40,000 years ago, something happens and the tools become sophisticated. Would you say this is a quantum leap or a simple somebody figured something out and showed some other people how to do it?
It certainly was not a quantum leap. It was more becoming a more standardized, and I think that's more an issue of demography. You start to see populations increase, and people are probably signaling to one another, and they're seeing for the first time in their life. I mean, this is hard to fathom for us today because we're around hundreds or thousands of people a day, depending on where you live. You know, 50,000 to 100,000 years ago, you probably never saw anybody outside of your extended family your entire life. It'd be amazing to see a stranger. So for the first time, once the world population reached a certain point in the millions, around 50,000 years ago, people started seeing strangers over the next hill. And, you know, it's just like a fraternity. You try to associate yourself with a group, and you start signaling, and that involves various things like making bone art, drawing on cave walls, and putting stylistic attributes on stone tools, which is what we see happening at that time.
So we're talking about an incremental improvement of people who now they're in contact with other people, and there's sort of a sharing and standardization of representational art, mm-hmm. of sort of a maybe a keep up with the Joneses. Well, he put decorations on his spear points, so I'm going to put decorations on my spear points.
Exactly.
And that sort of thing. All right, so this happens 50,000 years ago. 10,000 years ago, somebody figures out how to grow crops. And at that point, everything changes, mm-hmm. right? But now we're talking about, now they're, rather than a nomadic existence, which was necessitated, you had to follow the food around because the bison moved. So you had to, you couldn't be settled in one place.
Right.
Then suddenly, with the invention of agriculture, now it's beneficial to be centered in one place. Mm-hmm. And as people are centered in one place, you have two distinctly different and complementary patterns, where you have specialization, which is not everybody is a hunter. Some people are farmers, some people are soldiers, some people become, you know, scholars or priests, or, you know, some people become part of a bureaucratic leadership class. So now you have specialization in human life, and you also have warfare,
mm-hmm.
where you told me this. What's the oldest recorded that we know of, an actual battle where they see a number of people on a battlefield with, you know, evidence that, you know, somebody did put some whoopass on them?
Right. That was, there was one isolated incident in Africa. It was about, I want to say 11,000 years ago. And actually my mentor, my professor at SMU, his colleague, Fred Windorf, found the site, and he and Windorf excavated it. And it was pre-Neolithic, so they weren't farming yet, but it was just on the eve of the Neolithic. And it was a brutal cemetery where I think 60% of the burials suffered violent deaths. And that's judging from bone scars, which obviously it doesn't take a bone scar for you to kill you. You know, you could take a spear to the stomach and it wouldn't leave any traces for the archaeologist to find 10,000 years later. But, I mean, there was some brutal deaths.
But if an axe went 3 inches deep into your skull, yeah, that would be
exactly.
The mark.
Exactly. But the one that my professor always showed me a slide of in his classes was a particularly brutal killing. Was somebody had a scraper lodged between two of their vertebrae. And for those of you who know anything about stone tools, a scraper is exactly what it sounds like. It's this big, thick, round thing that you scrape the fat off the hides with, and nobody even knew you could stab somebody with it. So somebody strapped a scraper onto a spear and just did somebody in with it.
And, wow. So really makes your mind go. Was that a jealous husband? Was it was it like a Neolithic psychopath? I mean,
well, we're talking 60 or so murders or deaths in the cemetery. So it's definitely some sort of organized warfare at this point. And it was probably due to population increases, competition for resources, combined with some climatic effects like a drought or something that forced people to sort of fight over some resources. Now, that's an isolated incident. But like you said, Lou, warfare and craft specialization and organized militaries really come into play after the Neolithic Revolution, particularly with the urban revolution, which came shortly after the Neolithic Revolution. Well, one sort of important point for any archaeologists listening, they typically cringe when people say, well, you know, as soon as people invented agriculture, they had a great life and a lot of leisure time. It wasn't immediate, this leisure time that we enjoy today. In fact, people resisted switching over to agriculture and farming at all costs because it is a harder life than hunters and gatherers. They've done studies on living current hunters and gatherers versus pre-industrialized societies on living in various parts of Africa and Australia today. And you know, the hunters and gatherers don't live too hard of a life as long as there's enough food to go around. They work about, I think the average is about 25 hours a week, whereas the agriculturalists have to work 40 to 60 hours a week, you know, some serious hours. So that's the way it was before statehood. But once people started producing these, you know, getting better and better at refining their crops, their wheat and barley or whatever they're growing, and manufacturing these, then they began to get food surpluses. And then we witness wealth. And like you said, Lou, this leads to craft specialization. And what do you guys think? Think about the earliest states in the world, you know, Sumerians and Mesopotamia, the ancient Egyptians, or even the earliest New World folks like the Maya and the Incas and Aztecs. What are the three first craft specialists or jobs, as you will, that would occur in these societies?
Would weapon making be one of them?
Yeah, certainly a military is necessary, but what are the other two?
Would one of them be like making jewelry and trinkets?
Well, that...
Or am I on the wrong track?
You're right. That always goes along with it. But I'm thinking like the three sort of components that prop up the earliest societies. So you got your military, but who's controlling the military?
Certainly you have to have a leadership class, right?
Right. So you got your politicians, and then you got your priests and your religious class. So you find this in every earliest society. When this society evolves, you get these three craft specialists. You got your political leaders, your religious leaders, and your military to prop those up. And I find it fascinating that getting back to your original point, Lou, sort of this, what are the origins of this systematic exercise you're talking about? It probably was with the first military, because you obviously have to train, and one of the benefits of training to become a better warrior, becoming a better killing machine, is the physical fitness aspects to go with it. You need the strength and the coordination to do that. So yeah, I mean, I think you're onto something pretty neat, and you know, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, you can get an archaeologist talking for hours about this, because we don't get to have these sort of broad, grand, unifying theories in the scientific articles we publish, because we'd be chastised for it. But when we're talking, you know, among friends, it's always the kind of stuff we bring up.
Well, yeah, and really, you know, that's a thing that, you know, as a journalist, or maybe as a guy with just too much time on my hands because I work at home, don't have enough deadlines or something, you know, I think about these things. How did we get to the point where we are? Mm-hmm. You know, we certainly were not, you know, we didn't evolve to play with iPods and work on laptops and sit down at desks all day. You know, you look at the things that over these, you know, hundreds of thousands of years that, you know, just from the 200,000 years ago when we became Homo sapiens, what are our bodies designed to do? What are our brains designed to think about and focus on? And basically, you know, it's like none of the things that we actually try to use our bodies for today or to focus on today, which I find fascinating. And I'm not quite sure. I mean, obviously, there's nothing we can do about it. We can't go back, you know, short of an absolute catastrophe, go back to being, you know, hunters and gatherers. And I'm not sure that any of us could make it, you know, in that field anyway. I couldn't even figure out how to work the software for this podcast. I don't know how the hell I could ever figure out how to work a killing machine. So.
Well, I always taught my students how to nap flint, or at least produce a flake, one of the most basic elements of flint napping. And it's pretty hard, but, you know, there's something really satisfying about taking a piece of flint and a hammer stone and producing a nice, big, sharp flake. The sound it makes, I think it's just so ingrained in our evolution that it's actually, I think there's some therapy in it. We should actually open up like a new age shop in California somewhere, flint napping for the man.
You look at guys who will take a couple weekends a year and go off and do nothing but hunt, you know, who'll go off and fish a few times a year, and I look at them and I say, you know, they've really got the right idea. That's gotta be what at some point, you know, this is what we should do. You know, a couple of days out on a hunt, a couple of days out there on a fishing trip, you know, or going off into the wilderness and, you know, and chopping down trees and building something. You know, these are, you know, I think this sort of gets you closer to, I think there must be some sort of primordial memory in there that, you know, where you say, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with this body and this brain of mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, not all the absolutely. Time, certainly, but, you know, there's something about this.
Just getting up and moving around. I mean, it's such a novel concept in our evolution that we're to the point where we have such a technologically assisted, gigantic food surplus, and we don't even have to get out of a chair to eat it, you know, and that's unprecedented in our history. And, you know, I've been guilty of pulling extra hours at school and at work and, you know, dodging my workouts or whatnot, and it makes you feel like crap. And just getting up and stretching and going for a run or playing or doing anything, going to the gym, really helps out and makes you realize that humans are made to move, you know?
Sure. And it's fascinating to get, you know, just coming full circle, you know, before the advent of agriculture 10,000 years ago, of course, nobody ever needed to be told to exercise because, you know, that's what hunting and gathering is.
Right.
Is getting up and moving around. We invent agriculture. Now we've got classes of people who certainly the soldiers needed to train to be able to survive as soldiers. And here 10,000 years later, we've got a whole sport, bodybuilding. The only point of it is to look as if you've trained.
Mm-hmm.
and I think that, you know, granted it's an obscure little sport, but still I find that to be one of those just, you know, one of life's really, really strange ironies is that, you know, it's not even, we've gotten to the point where there's, you know, even the training we're doing just to live, you know, to remind our bodies what they're supposed to be able to do, somebody has found a way to make it pointless, to get nothing out of it, other than to look as if you've done this thing. I think, wow, that's just a little, there's something about that that's I don't know, still can't get my mind around it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how perceptions change, too, because I, you know, looking back at some of the ancient Egyptian writing, when the lower class were the ones who had to build the pyramids and do all the laborious work out in the sun, and they were the ones who were muscular and tan, and that was actually frowned upon in the ancient Egyptian societies. There's some of the scribes, the people who actually wrote the hieroglyphics, were some of the most prestigious members of society, and there are notes between scribes or between a scribe and his protege saying, you know, keep at it, keep learning how to write these hieroglyphics, because someday you will your arms will be skinny and pale. And they actually thought that was a great thing, you know. But now it's completely different. We all like to be tan and buff these days. We'd have been frowned upon in Egyptian society.
Well, speaking of somebody whose hair is going gray, a little bit of tan, sort of, you know. Otherwise, you just kind of look like, you know, a piece of paper that's been out in the sun too long. You know, you just like you're about to start flaking away. You've been rained on a few too many times, and you know, so a little bit of a tan. I'm starting to get to the point where I appreciate that again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
John, yeah. I just wanted to ask you quickly. I saw on Fox that aliens actually built the pyramids. Are you sure that it was the lower class? Or, I mean, I don't know if anyone's seen that. But
it's all part of the grand conspiracy. It was actually part of the 9/11 plot. You can all tie it in. It goes back to the aliens and the pyramids.
And you know, they didn't go to the moon either, just so you know.
You know, I speaking of haircuts, again, I go to this barber shop, and each time I get my haircut, it's a different person. And last time it was this middle-aged guy, and he starts talking and asks me what I do, and I told him an archaeologist, and he's like, really? You know, I study this you know, all the time. And he started going off on the alien conspiracies. And he's like, he's like, no, seriously, you guys really don't know what you're talking about. You're just, you know, you have your head up your ass. You're publishing your scientific journals, but you're not even willing to think about aliens. And I was like, oh, God. Like, you know, this guy's got a razor on my head. I'm not gonna try to insult him.
Was that Supercuts?
No. No, it's just a little barbershop down the road, a local barbershop. So I just let him babble on. I learned stuff from these conspiracy theorists. It's amazing how far people will go. And, you know, anybody who visits the JP Fitness forums, you know, go to the current events section. There's always some conspiracy theories being thrown around in there. And
and that's another sort of sign of devolution. You know, we talked about how 40,000-50,000 years ago, when bands of humans first came into contact with other bands of humans, that they began to share ideas, technology, that there became a, you know, probably some sort of one-upsmanship where one guy's trying to do something a little bit better than another. And now we've gotten to the point where, with all this information, people are simply filtering out all the information they don't want, anything that would go against their preconceived notions.
Yeah.
So we've sort of devolved to the point where, with all this information, all we've done is we've created so much clutter that people want to narrowly focus on whatever reminds them of whatever makes them feel good about their initial positions.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. frightening. You know what Google can do for you, what the internet can do for you these days. You can find whatever the hell you want to believe in on the internet, and a lot of it sounds you know, acceptable when you first read it.
It's frightening. You can learn the forms. You can learn the forms of journalism. You can learn the forms of newscasting, and you can manipulate those things so that you can use the form to make it sound like you're saying something that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that unless you're in a particular mindset, it doesn't make a bit of sense at all.
Right.
But if you never see any information that might contradict that point of view, then, yeah, it makes all the sense in the world. And you wonder, why doesn't everybody agree with me? Well, it's because, you know, you've chosen a channel of information that only you and a small number of people see, and it makes perfect sense to you. But if you would step outside that, you'd understand why it doesn't make sense to anybody else.
Yeah, yeah. It scares me to read some of the things going around the internet these days. Well, Lou, it certainly has been a pleasure. I guess, should we wrap it up? Do you guys have anything more you want to talk about?
We could throw in the listener questions if you got time.
Oh, yeah.
All right, sure. Let's fire them off, and this time I'll try to be short-winded. I don't do any aerobic exercise, so I'm all this talking. I'm just about ready to collapse. My heart rate monitor's going crazy.
Well, first off, is there a book you really want to write that no publisher will take on?
Yeah, the one John and I have just been talking about. I call it Homo Spartacus. The rise of the specialized human.
I'm game. You know, I'll be there for you. Anytime you can find a publisher, we'll do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would be one of those books that would sort of, you know, explain how we came to be. But unfortunately, I can't think of any kind of solution. You know, what are you going to tell somebody? Well, you know, go out and do a little hunting and gathering. Yeah, that's practical.
Well, it could kickstart our new age shop in California with flint napping for men.
Well, you're welcome for that idea, John. I think I'm kind of settled down here in Allentown, and I don't think it would work here.
I'll just be the sole flint napper then.
Right.
You guys got to try it, though, sometime.
Sure, yeah.
Well, cool.
Well, next one. I've currently been reading through the new rules of lifting, and I've been tweaking form on some of the exercises while I adjust my sleep schedule to give me more time to lift. I fit lifter profile number 3. Do I need to worry about how I feel almost nothing in my hamstrings and my glutes, but I'm always sore in my quads? How do I tell if they're overcompensating for weak hind legs or catching up to stronger hind legs?
Well, I don't like the sound of hind legs. It implies that we're four-legged creatures. Well, it's interesting. Did that question come from a man or from a woman?
That came from a man.
Okay, because one thing that I'm learning as I did the research to write the proposal for this book for women is that women tend to have more problems activating their extensor chain muscles. So they will overuse their quads, even on exercises like, you know, especially on exercises like squats, but certainly on deadlifts, lunges, and they will get less activation in their hamstrings, gluteals, and lower back muscles, which can create a lot of problems. If the muscles on the front of your body are overly strong, and if you're preferentially firing those muscles when you should be using the muscles on the back of your body. So if somebody is getting sore quads and not getting sore anywhere else, it seems to me like they're simply not activating those other muscles. I know personally, you know, if I, you know, for example, do, you know, change up and do a squat routine that I haven't done in a while, or if I do like an extended range of motion deadlift where, you know, instead of deadlifting from the floor, I'll stand on a like a low step 2 or 3 inches up and then deadlift from the floor there, so I've got an extra couple inches range of motion on that. I know it'll be hard to sit down for the next couple days because of the, you know, of the pain in the hams and glutes. So if somebody is not getting that pain, if they're getting it in their quads, then I would say definitely there's some issue with those muscles not firing properly. And it may be a matter of, you know, talking to a trainer and having somebody check out form. You know, certainly on a squat, if you're not feeling it in your hams and glutes, I'd almost recommend, you know, first I might look at your shoes and say, are you wearing cross trainers or running shoes when you're doing this? Because maybe you're just too high off the floor in your heels, and it's sort of transferring some weight forward toward your quads. I don't know if that would actually be the case, but that might be something I would recommend somebody try. Is like putting on a pair of Converse All Stars or wearing basketball shoes with the insoles torn out, where you're getting as flat to the floor as you possibly can, and seeing if that helps you feel it more in those extensor chain muscles. You definitely shouldn't be feeling everything in your quads.
And lastly, what was it like for someone without a degree in exercise science to study for and pass the CSCS exam? How would you recommend someone without an exercise science background to approach the material?
It depends on what kind of learner you are. If you're a book learner, then you've got to get that book, and I would recommend studying it for 6 months before you try to take the test. And that is no, you know, that's not being overly cautious. That I think that's real, that you really have to, it takes you that long to absorb it. I would also recommend that you might start with something a little bit easier. I got a couple of other certifications before I got the CSCS, so I had a 3-year running head start of being already certified through another organization, through ACE, and also, you know, reading about this stuff, writing about it regularly, and the CSCS was still a bear. I still studied very hard for 3 months. Took practice tests, you know, the whole thing, and still got basically the same grade I had gotten on the ACE test 3 years before, which is a much, much easier test. So I would say, you know, 6 months with a textbook, get a couple of other certifications, find a couple of cheap ones where they're going to test you on something so that you can practice taking the test and studying for a specific test and passing it. You know, reading anything you can get your hands on is great, although, you know, you're going to be tested on that NSCA textbook, so there may be a crossover point where it becomes detrimental to crowd your brain with a bunch of stuff from somebody else's textbook. But still, I would say that, you know, at least 6 months of studying that textbook and as many practice tests as you can get. And if you're not somebody who learns through books, if you're more of somebody who likes to be taught the material, then I would find some seminars and go attend those.
Sounds good. So, how did you study for 6 months to pass it?
No, but I, like I said, I was already six years into my career as a fitness journalist, and I'd been certified by ACE for 3 years. So I studied, but I studied for a solid 3 months before I took the test. In July, July 11th, 2001 was the day I passed the test.
Nice.
All right, that will pretty much wrap it up for this week's show. I'm Kevin Larrabee.
And I'm John Williams.
And I'm tired. I'm going to bed.
Thanks a lot for listening this week. And don't forget to check us out on iTunes. For this week's show notes, check out thefitcast.com. And again, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week where we will have the Chad Waterbury interview. See you next time.